Continuing in Mitzvah Shin Samech Hei 365, which is the Mitzvah of Sota, that when a woman is suspected of committing adultery, there's a certain procedure that you're supposed to do to her, and the halachos are as follows. Midinei HaMitzvah, we introduced a little bit last time, but here's going to go into the more of the specifics of how exactly you conduct the Sota process and the restrictions on the on certain aspects of it. Midini Amitzvah Mashamru Zikharan Lavracha, Sheinyan Hakinui Hu Kagon Shamar Leishto Bifne Edim Alti Sasri Im Ploni. That the way the Sota process is kicked off is that a man says to his wife in front of witnesses that I expect you not to be alone with a particular man. Without that action, then the Sota process cannot continue, that she has to. That he has to warn her in advance in front of Edim, and then witnesses have to see that she did seclude herself with this man. And at that point, you take her to the Beis HaMikdash. So Vafilu, so who's this man? You think it just would be some friend, somebody that ordinarily she might want to have an affair with, under, you know, she's so inclined. But it's not so. Afilu haya aviha, even if this man was her father, O achiha, or her brother, O goy, or a non-Jew, O eved, or a slave, O shachuf, or a shachuf v'hu ha'ish she'eino molid. That's a man who could not have children. And the Sefer Chinuch is being very euphemistic here, because a shachuf really means a man who can't perform, and not a man who can't have children. V'nistara im echad mehem bifnei edim. And she, again, after receiving this this warning, then she was alone with him in front of witnesses. Imshasa imo kidei tuma. Then she becomes a sota if she was alone with him to the amount of time that it takes to have an affair. So how long is that? Shehu kidei litzlos beitza ulagoma. The amount of time that it takes to roast an egg and swallow it. So you remember that eggs in the times of the Gemara used to be, you know, smaller than the huge eggs that we have in the stores nowadays. Well, they were most of the time what you would refer to as a medium-sized egg. So medium-sized eggs you don't see over here very much. You see large, extra large, jumbo, these types of eggs. But medium eggs are you occasionally see them. But a lot of times they're just used for commercial food production because, you know, in America we like everything big, so we don't want these to waste our time with these tiny eggs. So medium-sized eggs are, you know, smallish, and you roast it over and of coals. You know, you let it roast a little bit to congeal somewhat, so it's not totally raw. Then you open the egg and you swallow it. They used to just put it in their mouth and swallow the whole thing whole. If it's not hard-boiled, you don't need to chew it. You just swallow the soft-boiled egg. So apparently the amount of time you take this little egg, you put it on the fire, it gets edible, then you open it up and swallow it. That's the amount of time that it takes a couple to get to the point of that she would actually become usher to her husband if they were together and they would be intending to have an affair. The Gemara gives many different shiurim of this, which Rabbi Schwartz, I'm sure, will get to soon. So there's a funny line in the Gemara. So how did they know what was? Well, why did they give so wildly different? Why did they give so many different shiurim? That each of the Amoraim that gave a different shiur was just judging by himself how long it took him to have relations. Permissible relations with his wife, we're talking about in that case, but he has just applied it to the amount of time that it took to be kedei tuma. But the accepted shear is again the shear of roasting an egg and then swallowing it. And this shear actually it might have ramifications nowadays as well, in terms of the laws of yichud. That if a man and a woman, you know, they're not, and they're except closely related, so are not allowed to be alone together because of the law of Yichud. So is there a minimum amount of time that they're not allowed to be together? So let's say, you know, there'd be a room and you'd lock the room, but they'd only be in the room for 10 seconds together. So that's presumably not enough time to even to roast an egg and to swallow it. So is that the usur at all? Maybe that's completely a mutter for it to be in yichud for a very short period of time. That's less than kidei litzlos beitza ula goma. So if that's the case, which not everybody agrees to, but many poskim do apply this shear of kidei litzlos beitza ula goma to a regular yichud that we'd encounter nowadays as well. So it's important to know how long this is. So the shiurim range wildly for how long this is. I think for between 30 seconds and 5 minutes. Something like that. So we try not to be in yichud because of the different opinions for this, as well as the opinion that rejects this entirely, this premise entirely, that there is a minimum shiur for yichud. So you try not to be in yichud for even a tiny period of time. Where this does come into play would be like in an elevator. So most poskim assume that there's no yichud in an elevator. There's no problem of yichud in an elevator because the idea is it could stop at any second. Anybody could press the button. And if you're going to be alone, it's going to be just for, you know, a couple seconds maximum. So even if it doesn't actually stop, maybe you're going from floor zero to 100. But in theory, someone on floor 15 could press the button. So then it wouldn't be a problem of yichud. But,
And there's a camera there, does that matter?
Oh, camera, that's good, yeah. Yeah, there's not a camera in every single elevator in the world, but...
A lot of them, though, these days.
Yeah, no, a camera would help, unless you don't... it depends, because I don't know if the camera... It depends if the camera is monitored, if the security guard, is sworn to secrecy, and he's not allowed to... His confidentiality is not allowed to reveal anything he saw in the camera, unless it's dangerous. No, or something like that, that would lead to criminal prosecution.
But how can you tell whether it's a rape or a consensual?
Good, Shaila. Okay. So at this point that they were alone together to the amount of time that would take to roast an egg and swallow it, then she now becomes forbidden to her husband until she drinks the waters, and then it will be determined whether she actually... did defile herself or not. Ubizman she'ein sham meisota. So what happens nowadays if a husband does a kinui to his wife and she then goes into seclusion with this man? Te'aser olav le'olam v'teitze b'lo k'tuba. The procedure that would have to be followed is that, first of all, they would never allow to be together again because presumption at this point would be that she did have an affair, and then we know that we have the principle of asur la baal, asur la boel, that if a woman has an affair, then she is no longer allowed to be with her husband, and she's also not allowed to be with her paramour either. Even if her husband were to divorce her as he's supposed to do, then she's not allowed to marry the paramour. That once she commits this act, then she becomes asur to both parties. So here, even though we don't know for sure that she did have the affair, nevertheless, since you did the official procedure that would set the sota process in motion, and you don't have the possibility of clarifying it by her drinking the waters of the sota, so therefore you have no choice but for her to get divorced. The couple have to get divorced, and she would not receive her ksuba. That ksuba is a monetary document, as we know, that when the marriage ends, so the woman is entitled to funds. So she would not be paid her ksuba. She didn't get rewarded for this. She did something that she's not supposed to do, and that she caused the divorce to happen. So when such things happen, so she doesn't get rewarded by being paid her ksuba. The ksuba essentially is a defense to make sure that the husband does not frivolously divorce his wife, that when he decides to get divorced, so then he has to take it very seriously. The decision has to be very level-headed. So... here the point is that there's no decision that needs to be made. Obviously, he has to divorce her, and she deserves it, so therefore she doesn't get her ksuba. Aval amar lo al tedabri imish ploni ein zekinui. But if he says to her, don't speak to this man, he doesn't say don't seclude yourself with this man, but don't speak to this man, that's not called a kinui. Below te'asar alav bekinui ze afal pishanista ra'imo. So even if he warns her, don't talk to this guy, and then she's secluded with him, that is not considered a kinoi, and she would not do the sota procedure. Kine la bifnei shnayim v'ra osahu below edim shenistor emoso shekinoa. So what happens if he does the kinoi, tells her don't be alone with this guy, and then witnesses don't come to say that she was secluded with this guy in the end, but he saw it himself personally. Harizu asura la v'yotzi v'yiteng suba. So she now becomes usur to him, but he has to pay the ksuba when he divorces her, because shein yochol ashkos al piatzmo. The rule is that the husband is not allowed to be the catalyst for the sota procedure taking place. So if he says, hey, I saw her violate my kinoi, so that doesn't count. So he does not have the recourse of the sota procedure. And it's just the lack of availability of the sota procedure that's hampering their being together. But rather, it's an impossibility to do the sota procedure, even if it were available, because it was he was the person who said that she now needs to drink. So therefore, he has to pay the ksuba, because, again, this official sota procedure did not start in motion. That if he heard that it's now town gossip, that everybody knows, even the ladies who are just sitting at night outside and they're spinning. So they're spinning.
Spinning their tails.
Tails as well as thread. So they're now, everybody's talking about it. Everybody knows, or seems to know, that this woman had an affair. So even so, that is not sufficient grounds to do the sota procedure. And if they are to get divorced, then he would have to pay the ksuba. So there are certain women that the Bezdin takes the place of the husband. The rabbis in the town get together and they say, well, your husband isn't here, so we're going to do it for him because you're really not behaving properly. He doesn't have the opportunity to do it because either he's become a deaf mute. And we know in halacha, a deaf mute has the status of a shota, someone who is, insane and can't really function properly. So it's a shaila whether this applies nowadays, because now we have special schools for deaf mutes and they can really be trained to function somewhat normally. So it's a question as to how much this applies. But in the olden days, it was assumed that a deaf mute was not able to function at all. Or he became literally insane. Or he was away in a different country, or if he was in jail and he wouldn't have any opportunity to be able to interact with his wife in a meaningful way to be mekane her. So then the Bezdin does it for her. If the Bezdin does this, then she violates the kinui, so she doesn't get the meisota, because only the husband's kinui is a real official kinui. So if the Bezdin is mekane her instead of the husband, so she cannot drink the water, but she would still not be able to get her ksuba when her husband came back, because that's just a monetary thing. That's not, a ritual thing with a meisota. So since they are on behalf of the husband are officially lodging a complaint against her and she violated it, then that is sufficient to make sure that she does not get her ksuba when they get divorced. V'zeha inyan hu kishishamu bezdin she'ha'am eranani ma'chareya me'adam echad. So how would you determine whether it's appropriate for the Bezdin to take such a step? So if you hear that people are sort of chasing after her, they're saying, hey, everybody's saying, you did bad. You're not faithful to your husband with this guy. Shekorin la ve'omrim la al tatri imo. So the Bezdin, once they hear this rumor that people are pursuing her with these accusations, then they say, okay, we're going to take a step back. No more accusations for now. We're going to do a kinoi. We're going to say, don't be alone with this person that people are accusing you of having an affair with. So vimnistera imo achar kein bevezdin osrin osal baila laolam. And if she then becomes secluded after the Bezdin issues their kinui, then she will not be permitted to her husband. The korin ksubasa, you rip the ksuba. Uchshiyavu baila nosin lagen. When the husband becomes available, then at that point he issues again. He would not have to pay the ksuba. Bumasha amru shim shasisa meha morim pam achas al ish echad. You can't have twice that a woman will drink the sota water is because of an accusation with the same man. So again, the husband does the kinoy once, she's alone with him, then they do the sota procedure, she drinks the water, and she's found to be blameless, not exactly blameless, but innocent of this particular charge, then fine, so that she can go back to be with her husband. And then the husband notices that she didn't learn her lesson even after this whole ordeal, and she's acting inappropriately with the same very same man again. So then he says, no, I'm being mekana you again. I don't want you to be alone with him. And she goes in and she's alone with him. Then at that point, she cannot drink the meisota. She cannot drink the sota again for the same man. The only recourse is divorce. And she would not receive her ksuba. Harry said that if it were different men, then she could drink the meisota even 100 times.
If she keeps doing this stuff, we have a problem here.
Okay. You could get divorced if you want.
Okay.
But if the husband is very, very tolerant, and so then they keep doing the thing over and over again.
Wasn't like, I noticed if she drank the waters and, was acquitted, she was, passed the test. Wasn't one of the effects of it was to act like a fertility drug, and she was supposed to conceive and...
Yeah, so maybe she'll have 100 kids. Yeah.
And will they look like the husband? That's the question.
Yeah, they'll look like the husband. They'll, it says that it doesn't mean that you get bumped up with a fertility. It's not that, it depends where you were before. If she couldn't have kids at all before, then if she drinks the mesota and she's innocent, then she'll now be able to have a child. If she used to have only girls, then she'll start having boys.
Oh, my God.
And if she had very difficult labors, she conceived and gave birth the labors were very difficult. Then after drinking the water, she'll start having very easy childbirth. So maybe after the 100 times, it's not that she's going to have more kids, but the labor will now be a super breeze. She won't even, she'll get slightly less painful each time, but, and then by the end, she'll just barely even notice that it's going on, and she'll just pop the kid out.
All right. I was going to say, I guess after, what she said, even after going through it once, and you're still hanging out with the same guy, it was not that healthy of a marriage, and they probably should,
Well, 100 different guys also not so much better.
Maybe twice with the same guy is not quite as awful as, who knows.
I don't know.
Those people didn't get married for the same kind of reasons we get married today.
Depends. I don't know. Yeah, different things, different periods of history. That's true. Maybe arranged is the way to go. Don't knock arranged. Chassidim, look at Chassidim have. There have been studies about this that if they have, even though they have basically arranged marriages, that Lemaisa they get the job done. They get married young and they. Most of them have relatively happy marriages.
But they also and, have issues.
Okay, there's some issues, but I don't know if the issues are so much greater than, those in the modern Orthodox or not from community where you take your time and you... Ul olam ein kofen osa lishtos bein she'amra nitmesi o she'amra eini temea ve'eini shosa, that the drinking the water is the woman's choice. She has the option to decline. So there are two ways she can decline. One is by saying, yeah, you're right. I admit it. I come clean. I admit it. I did not behave appropriately, and I have become defiled, for lack of a better term. Oh, she'amra, eini tameh ve'eini shosa. No, I don't want to drink the water. But the woman used to be terrified of this. I mean, there's an option. Even if she knew she was innocent, she knew she was drinking something that, if she wasn't innocent, that she would explode, basically. So it's a frightening procedure. So a lot of women didn't want to do it. They weren't interested in doing it, even though they're supposed to have faith that, and they tell her, the Chazal tell us that in the process, so the Kohanim and the Bezdin used to tell her, don't worry, you can drink it, you'll be fine. If you're really innocent, you have nothing to worry about. Nevertheless, it's scary, just like... we try to avoid taking a shavua. Even in Bezdin, people, went through great lengths that they would pay money they didn't have to, or they would go through extended litigation procedures to avoid having to take an oath. So even if they knew that they were telling the truth and they didn't really have anything to worry about taking an oath, nevertheless, there's we're scared of the possibility of maybe something going wrong and you swearing about something that you didn't know 100%. So it's nerve-wracking. So the same thing. So a lot of women, I don't think this happened so many times. Again, we had a shita that didn't happen at all. But women were nervous about it, so they say, no, I'm really an innocent, but I do not wish to drink the water. I'm not going there. Elateitze below ksuba. So in either one of these cases, again, if she chooses not to drink it, v'teyase levayla l'olam, she just gets divorced without the ksuba, and she'll never be permitted again to her husband. But if the husband says, I'm not interested in going to Yerushalayim right now to have her drink the water, then he has to pay her the ksuba because, hey, she could say, wait a minute, why are you denying me my ksuba? I'm entitled to it. I want to drink the water. I'm going to get, I'm innocent, so I'm going to get the blessings of the water. I'm going to prove that I could go back to you. So why should I be financially penalized? No, so in such a case, the husband actually does have to pay the wife the ksuba. So this only applies, by the way, that a woman can decline the water before the point that the Megillah is erased. What's the Megillah? So when the Sota has her procedure, so they take, they make a little drink for her, that's the water. So they take water from the kiyor, that's the official water receptacle in the Beis HaMikdash that the Kohanim used to use to wash their hands and feet. And they used to mix with the official holy water from the kiyor with the with a little bit from the ground. There used to be a square tile in the floor of the Beis HaMikdash. So one of the tiles used to have a ring attached to it, so it could be pulled up. And then since it says in the Chumash, Umin ha'afar asher yeh bekarka mishkan, that part of the drink is the ground that is under the tabernacle. So the tabernacle is not a tabernacle anymore. We're transferred to the Beis HaMikdash. So you take a ring and you pull up this tile from the floor of the Beis HaMikdash, and you take some of the earth from underneath the Beis HaMikdash. You mix that in, and then you have what's called the Megillah Sota, which Sefer Chinuch doesn't even mention here. Sometimes it's funny. We've noticed that the Sefer Chinuch, when he talks about mitzvahs that are no longer applicable, sometimes he goes at length and discusses all the details of this mitzvah. Over here, you know, everybody's interested in the mitzvah Sota. It's such a unique mitzvah that he doesn't even tell us hardly anything about the procedure. So there is what's called the Megillah Sota, which is that the Kohen has to write the Megillah, the part of the Torah that discusses, that mentions the curses that are given to the Sota, out on a piece of, I won't say parchment. Parchment is not necessarily kosher for this. See my article on Chakira that it's parchment. When the Chazal are talking about skin that you write on, they don't necessarily mean what we call nowadays parchment, but rather skin that's more like leather, that's fully tanned, like a shoe leather. So they used to take ink, soluble ink, which is what the Chazal say lechatchila, because this is what you're supposed to use for writing the Sefer Torah. They take ink that's just basically made of soot, that gives it the black color, and a glue, essentially, that attaches it to the paper, that attaches the soot, not the paper in this case, but to the writing surface. And you mix the ink together, which is just, again, soot and glue, and you write on the Megillah, on the piece of leather, essentially, the text of the curses for the Sota, and then you erase it. So since this is a very simple ink that dissolves very easily and doesn't really attach itself very strongly to the leather, so you could erase it. You just erase the ink that into the drink, and then you let the woman drink the water. So it says that for the ink for that you write this Megillah, is not allowed to contain kankantum, which most of the ink for Sifrei Torah nowadays does contain, because it makes it starker, makes it more permanent. But you're not allowed to use that for the Megillah Sota, because it's supposed to completely dissolve and be able to be completely erased without leaving anything behind. If you take kankantum-based ink, which is iron sulfate, it's like a metallic compound, and you erase it, so there's going to be some black left. Mm. on the. But if you have just the simpler ink that's made of soot and a glue, then when you erase it into the water, so you can erase it, it will be completely clean. And it says in the halach actually that you have to, when you erase the Megillah Sota, you have to erase and erase and erase and erase till there's absolutely no black remnants, shadows left on the Megillah, and the entire text has to be in the Megillah. Yeah.
I mean, in the water. Are you allowed to reuse the leather for another time if it's completely
You're allowed to reuse
off?
The letter. The leather. Leather, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's just a random.
That's a question. I don't know offhand. You're not allowed. There's a din that the Megillah has to be written lishma. That the Megillah of the Sota has to be written for this particular Sota.
Not a pre-printed form.
Right. It has to be written by hand, but it's...
not even a pre-prepared form.
Right, correct. It has to be written for specifically for this woman, and that, in a sense, is like a get.
Right.
A get also, there's a halacha that when a couple gets a divorce, that this particular document has to be written for this man, for this particular woman, and for the sake of divorce. So it's a similar halacha regarding the Megillah Sota, that it has to be written with the express intent that it be used for this particular Sota. So after you erase it, can you reuse the leather? Good question. I don't recall seeing an explicit discussion
it's
of that.
It's just a random.
But I'm sure it's discussed. I'm sure I'm just missing something.
Fine tuning.
Fine. So that's the way it works with the Megillah Sota. Oh, so once you write the Megillah, so then at that point the woman doesn't really have a choice anymore. At that point she has to decline drinking before the Megillah is written, because hey, we already wrote Shem Hashem for you. And we're about to erase it. This is the one time where it's permissible to erase the name of God.
Right.
That normally in halacha, where you're not allowed, you're never allowed to erase the name of God, any name of God, any, I mean, within a certain set of names. They said no, too late. So at this point, you force her to drink. Once the Megillah is written, so then you force the woman to drink, and come what may, either she will, you know, die, or she will get blessed. V'yesh nashim, there are women that don't drink the water. She'ein anshosos afal pi sheratzu heinu balein. They could say, yeah, I want to drink, and the husband could say, yeah, I want you to drink as well. V'chamesh esrei nashim hein, there are 15. Ve'elu hein, arusa v'shomeres yavam. That women who are not fully 100% married.
You have arusa.
So dichsiv tachas isha. We'll explain. We'll go back and I'll just explain what that means in a second, and then we'll discuss how it's derived from the pasuk. The elu adayin einon tachas ish. So it says that the woman shall stray from under her husband, meaning under her husband's domain, basically. I mean, and these types of women are not yet under their husband's domain. So what? So and first of all, Shomeres Yava means a woman who's unfortunately her husband has died childless, and she's awaiting Yibum. She is now required. She's a zukuka, that she is required now to marry or undergo chalitza with her husband's brother. So until she goes to live with her husband's brother, she's called a Shomeres Yavam. And since she's not fully married yet, she has to marry this particular guy. She has some sort of halachic relationship, zika, to this particular man, her husband's brother. Nevertheless, since they haven't actually consummated their relationship and now are fully halachically married, then she cannot become a sota, even if he does the whole kinui procedure. Same thing that an arusa, that a woman who's undergone only the first stage of halachic marriage and not the second stage. We know that there is erusin, which is the first stage, where the husband gives the wife a ring. That's in the way we normally do it nowadays. There are other ways to do it as well. And he says, harayan mekudeshesli. So at that point, she becomes fully committed to him, to the extent that if she now had relations with someone else, then she'd be liable to the full penalty and of committing adultery. And and if she wants to sever this relationship, she now requires a get. But they're still not allowed to live together until they do the second stage of marriage, halachic marriage, which is called nisuin, where they actually move in together. Nowadays we do erusin and nisuin all together. under the chuppah. But in the olden days, sometimes they used to do erusin first and then nisuin only several months later. And in modern Hebrew, it's very confusing that erusin means engagement, but it's confusing for those for people who are learning halacha. That what we call in modern Hebrew erusin has no halachic status whatsoever. Obviously, that does not require get to sever it. But whoever started introducing that term into modern Hebrew should be expelled from Hebrew usage. Okay, so in Arusa, fine. So even though again they can only separate with a get, they are married to a certain extent since they have not yet moved in together. Then they're not considered fully married. She's not in her husband's domain. And therefore, even if he would do kinui during the status of her being an arusa, then he would not be allowed to take her to the Beis HaMikdash to drink the sota water. They would just have to get divorced. Oh, so there's one other halacha that's related to this that's not mentioned by the Sefer HaChinuch explicitly, which has some contemporary relevance, which is that even if they did nisuin, they had the second stage of marriage, meaning they had a chuppah, they had the sheva brachos, she came to live in his house, they did nisuin, they're fully 100% married, they can live together as they wish. If they had not consummated their marriage yet, that normally nisuin, the assumption of nisuin is that you consummate your marriage, and that's basically what constitutes the nisuin. But even if they are doing nisuin, but they left out the consummation, then he still cannot be mashke her. He cannot have her drink the water. Because it says, im shochav ish osach mi balade ishech, that the problem is of a sota, that someone has slept with you other than your husband. So the fact that it's other than your husband, it means that the woman needs to have had relations with her husband at least once, so that otherwise they can't call the second guy relations other than your husband, because they didn't have relations yet. So even if they basically did nisuin, but they had not had relations yet, so then the husband cannot take the woman does not drink the sota waters. Yeah.
I'm not sure how this fits in here, but my impression is from all this stuff I read about this stuff,
yeah,
is that the Yichud rule is sort of symbolic of having had relations, no?
That's complicated.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Right, so we assume... okay, so let me explain what I mean by the contemporary...
Right.
You could, halachically, yeah, okay, but fine. But the that gets to where I'm going with the contemporary application. That we know that one of the stages of the sota procedure is that before she even drinks the water, before the Megillah is written, so she's publicly degraded by the Kohen. This is part of a ploy, right, as Chazal put it, to get her to confess that if she keeps being degraded, they schlep her back and forth across the Beis HaMikdash, that they really try to degrade her to get her to confess so she can avoid drinking the sota water. We could avoid erasing the name of God. But okay,
and we could avoid her exploding.
Right.
That might even be a little more important to some of us.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, no. I mean, you could argue that if she argues she deserves it. Fine. But the
and if he's
part of the around, what is right, but then the waters doesn't work. You weren't here last week. We pointed out that in order for the water to work to kill the wife, basically, the husband either way, for the blessing or not, the husband has to be blameless in terms of his right. So if he even had any act of relations his entire life that was not halachically sanctioned,
his entire life, since he was 12,
since he was bar mitzvah, basically, since he was bar mitzvah, then the water doesn't work on his wife.
Oh, that's pretty progressive, people.
We pointed out last week. We said Chaval, Mrs. Birnbaum isn't here. She'd point out how egalitarian the halacha is.
I'm guilty with an explanation. I was doing a really important shiva.
No, it's fine. I'm just saying
that I couldn't do anything.
It's fine. It's fine. Yeah.
I'm so. Fair is fair.
One of the procedures that the Kohen does for the woman, as is well known, is that he takes off her head covering,
right.
He exposes her hair, and undoes it. If it's in braids, so then he undoes it, which is considered to be the most degrading hairstyle. A refined hairstyle for a woman in ancient times was braided. That symbolized being put together and organized and refined and modest, whereas having your hair flowing loose made you look like...
A loose woman,
exactly. So from here we derive, Chazal in Maseches Ksubas derives that obviously you see from here that the proper conduct for Jewish women is to cover their hair. This is the famous source in the Chumash for the what we think of nowadays as the requirement for a married woman to cover her hair. So the question is, when does a woman have to start covering her hair after she gets married? Well, what point in the ceremony? So some poskim said that it's right after she gets the ring. Once she gets the ring, she has to start covering her hair. She's now married. The problem with this, although some poskim do say this and they have an explanation for why it could still be, the problem is that the Gemara in the Mishnah in Ksubas in the beginning of the second parak clearly states that when a woman was being married for the first time, one of the signs that it was her first marriage was that she used to go from her father's house to her husband's house with her hair uncovered as a particular sign of virginity. So they say, well, how could it be? She was an Arusa already. She had the ring. She just she wasn't a Nesua yet. She wasn't fully married. So therefore, according to most poskim, again, there are justifications for the poskim who say that even after Erisin, that woman has to cover her hair. Most poskim hold that it would be after Nisuin, that after she's Nisuin. So when is the Nisuin? You have two options. One is
under the
chuppah, when you have the Sheva Brachos and the chuppah, that constitutes Nisuin. That's full 100% halachic marriage. So then a woman has to cover her hair already starting at that time.
You put on the wig in the Yichud room.
Oh, so then that's... So in some communities, like in Yekas, I think, generally have this custom, that the bride goes to the chuppah already with a sheitel, because there's going to be at some point in the ceremony where she becomes a nesua. Chassidish also. So Chassidish also, many Chassidish communities, that's also the case, that they wear a sheitel to the chuppah. Because at some point during the course of this ceremony, she's going to become a nesua in 1 second, so there's no could be time. You have to, you know, you have to put on the sheitel within the span of 1 second, so it's not clear exactly at what point she would become a nesua. Maybe as soon as she's under the chuppah, when she has the ring, she becomes a nesua, so you have to get the ring, and then, you know, who knows, it's too hard to come up with the exact time when she has to put it on, so it's just easier to go to the chuppah already with a sheitel. So other shittas hold that sort of nisuin, but the real full nisuin is the yichud room. The yichud room. So there are communities, Svardim, I think, but they don't usually do the yichud room at the wedding. They sometimes do the yichud after the wedding. But assuming you did the yichud even during the wedding, so Svardim would hold that the kala has to start covering her hair after the yichud room, which makes for a much more convenient time to change your headgear. Then under the chuppah at some point, or to wear it before the chuppah.
They have no yichud room at the wedding?
Most Svardim don't have yichud room at the wedding. They do yichud afterwards. Yeah.
What is afterwards?
Just after the meal. Then they go to when they're going home for the night. So then they just do the yichud at that point. So there are even Ashkenazim who do this, that they put on a head covering in the Yichurim. So you'd think that makes the most sense, right? Now she's a Nisua. She's at the Yichurim. Now she's a real Nisua. So she for sure has to cover her. So the Maisa, the Minag in America, at least in America, I don't know exactly what they did in various parts of Europe, in America for the last 100 years or so, at least for those who cover their hair at all, but the minag is that you don't cover your hair among, again, non-Hasidish, non-Yekish communities. So the most prevalent minag, I'm not saying everyone, Chavetz Chaim, I think, they're not regular Misnagdisha Jews, they also wear a sheitel to the chuppah. Okay, but the most non-Hasidim, non-Yekis, we only start covering their hair the morning after the wedding. Uh-huh. Why? Why?
Well, the morning after.
She's already in the Suwa beforehand.
But now she's really...
She's already in the Suwa, so she should have to start covering her hair before. So Rav Moshe Feinstein justified this minhag with a very interesting way. He says, oh, you learn out that a married woman has to cover her hair from the sota experience. And a woman could not become a sota unless she had had relations with her husband at least once.
Brilliant.
So you see from that, that a woman doesn't have to cover her hair until she could theoretically become a sota, which is the morning after the wedding.
Brilliant.
And even if they didn't succeed on the wedding night, so then she still covers her the morning after because we're not publicizing this fact. Okay. It was assumed to be that they were together on the wedding night. So it's a chiddush. It's a chiddush. It's used to justify the minhag, but it is a big chiddush, but nevertheless, that is the most prevalent, I think, in circles we would be most familiar with, that is the most prevalent minhag here in America and even some places in Eretz Yisrael. That they don't cover there until the morning after the wedding, which is based on this interesting novel logic. It makes it's yeah, but it's too technical, you know. It's like saying it's not. In other words, when Chazal say the laws for the covering hair are derived from Sota, it's not necessarily they mean that it's an exact technical right. matchup. They're saying no. You see from here that the modest thing to do is to cover your hair, but Reb Moshe Feinstein is saying that's how you can justify it by saying it's an exact. Technical
isn't
matchup.
It also yeah? that from the point of view of somebody, a male person who would be interested in messing around with her, that once she's under the chuppah, she's forbidden to everybody else.
Right. So.
So that would.
You mean
be
if she's in a wedding dress? So that's.
If she's in a wedding dress already, so she's obviously forbidden to anybody else. So, or she's going to be in 30 seconds or whatever. Anyway, guys, this is.
A woman who finds covering her hair very uncomfortable. So let her just wear a wedding dress every day, so that everybody will know that she's married.
That wasn't the point.
Really. I understand, but okay.
But I mean, it's.
I don't know.
You're signaling to the rest of the world that this woman is now not available, even if she didn't.
I understand.
She's still not available.
Rabbi Willig. Holds, as he told my wife when we had our pre-wedding meeting with him as a Masada Kiddushin. So he holds, I've heard him say explanations of this and Shiurim as well, that he holds that, Rav Moshe Feinstein is a Chiddush, but we rely on that, so that she doesn't have to cover her hair fully to the extent that she would be during her marriage until the morning after. But still, it's not proper to completely dispense with any type of hair covering after the yichud, at least. That's why he holds that the bride should not take off her headpiece.
Oh.
Even in modern Orthodox circles, whatever, that she should not take off her headpiece during the wedding meal and the dancing and all these things.
She probably doesn't want to, though.
I've been to a lot of weddings where they do.
No.
It's bouncing around while they're dancing. There are a lot of brides who want to, at the first opportunity after the chuppah, they off with a thing and they just go completely bareheaded during the rest of the wedding. So that's what Rabbi Willig doesn't like. He says it's, again, even if we wouldn't assume that such would be an appropriate, such a tiny little piece would be an appropriate head covering for a regular married woman, nevertheless, because of the, including the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Minhag, so you don't require a full head covering, but you still should have at least this partial type of head covering. As soon after the yichud. I mean, if you're asking me to paskin the shaila, I mean, I'm not in a league with Rav Moshe, and I'm not saying we have to change the minhag. But if you're asking me to paskin the shaila, I would have said to put on a full head covering during the yichud. But okay, the minhag is very important. We don't dispense with it unnecessarily. Okay. Fine. Uktana Eishes Gadol. An adult man who was married to a girl under bas mitzvah, then she would also not drink the water. Because it says, Dichsiv Asher Tiste Isha, that when a woman strays from her husband, Vezo eina isha adayin. She is not yet a woman. She's still a girl. Ugdola eishes katan, and an adult woman who's married to a boy under bar mitzvah. Dichsiv tachas isha. She shall stray from under her man's, literally. In most languages, there's not a separate word for husband and wife, but you use the word for man and woman. You say my man or my woman. It's only in English, not only in English, but English is one of the only languages where you you have separate words for husband and wife. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What other languages?
Modern? In French, you say ma femme, my wife, my woman.
Right. Yeah.
I guess in Marie also. Okay. Whatever. There is a possible word, but in a lot of languages, you just say my man or my woman. You don't say.
Yeah. Oh, I see. It's gender distinct. Yeah.
It's a gender distinction, not a status relationship. Distinction. Yeah. Status. That's what you meant.
You say my man, my woman, not my husband, my wife.
Right.
It's not like a gender. You're looking for gender into a word like.
Oh that. No. Fine. So under her man, literally, which is translated in English from under her husband. So v'zeh adayin eino ish. He's not a man yet. He's still a boy.
Well, why is she married to him if he's not a man? Hello.
Okay, well, we're talking theoretical cases. V'eishes androgynos. If she's the wife of a what we call nowadays a hermaphrodite, with both male and female sexual organs. Then dichsiv isha, again, it has to be her man. Vezeh eino ish gamur. He's not a full man, he's a hermaphrodite. Veisha suma, and the wife of a blind man, dichsiv ve'ne'alam me'enei isha, that her transgression shall be concealed from the eyes of her man. Vezeh ein lo einayim. He has no functioning eyes. So therefore, he can't say it was concealed from his eyes.
Ooh, that's mean. Cheating on somebody who can't even see. That's mean.
Yeah. Vachigeres. That's nice to cheat on someone who can't see either. Vachigeres. If the woman is lame, dichsiv ve'hemid ha'koheines ha'isha, that part of the procedure is that the Kohen stands the woman up before God and then takes off her head covering, etc., Vezo eina yichol olamod. This woman cannot stand. Umi she'ein lo kaf yad, if she doesn't have a hand, dichsiv, benosan al kafeha, you put the offering, again, part of the procedure was there was a special mincha offering, a meal offering that was offered. And he says, you put it on her hands. Vezo ein lo kaf. She doesn't have a hand. Vechein imaisa yada akuma o yevesha, if she had a distorted hand, a malformed hand, or dried up and not really functioning. She'eino yechol alikach b'hareze kemi she'einla. V'afilu ha'isa yechol alikach b'achas levad eino shosa. That even if she could take it with one hand was functioning, then she doesn't drink the waters. Dichsiv kapeha. It's in the plural, her hands. You have to put the offering on her hands. If she doesn't have both functioning hands, she cannot drink the water. V'ha'ilemes, she is mute. Dichsiv amra ha'isha. Then part of the procedure is that she has to respond to the Kohen and say amen. Umi she'ena shomas, she's deaf. This again is not a chereshes in the classical halachic literature. Chereshes means in modern Hebrew, it would mean a woman who's just deaf, but in classical halachic literature, it means deaf mute. So even if she is not mute, she just cannot hear. Dichsiv ve'amar el ha'isha, the Kohen has to speak to the wife, and she has to hear what he says.
Why is it seri lemet en chereshet? It seems like two distinct things, not the same.
It is two distinct things. Even
no, but you said chereshet means deaf mute. So why?
No, but he doesn't. Chereshet is not included in the list here. There's ilemet and misheina shomat. So, right. So a chereshet is obviously included in either one of those categories, either ilemet or misheina shomat. Then in modern Hebrew, chereshet means just a woman who's deaf, but in the classical halakhic literature, it means deaf mute. So even if she's not both deaf and mute, she's either deaf or mute, she also cannot drink the sota water. V'chein hu shaya chigir o katua o ilem o cheresh, that he is, say, the man also, if he was lame or had his hand or leg cut off, or he was mute or deaf mute, v'chein hisha isa sumav, she was blind, dichsiv isha tachas isha, That same thing, even though there's no specific drasha regarding a woman being blind, nevertheless, you see, it says isha tachas isha, a woman from under her man. So there's an analogy between both the man and the woman. So they both have cannot have physical defects, the same physical defects. The defects. V'yaser pratea, we're just going to finish this quickly. V'yaser pratea v'seder hashkas hasota v'ezet tzad bok niyamayim osa v'ezet tzad ein bok niyosa. That the rest of the details, how can the water test her, when does it not test her, that we talked about last time. Hakol mizbar yavim masechta benu yalzev yimasecha sota. It's all explained in masecha sota. V'negas mitzvah zo bizman abayis. This is in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. V'zecharim lefi shalei amutal shiyasu l'noshim amayis hazeh kidei livdo gosom imrosh etzricho sein l'chach. So the mitzvah is on the men to make sure it's done to the woman if it's necessary. It's only the time of the Sanhedrin of 71 elders. So it's only when that we have the presence of the full Sanhedrin of 71 members that you do the sota. And of course, you have to have the base mikdash, etc. And then it said even during those times, they stopped doing it because there were too many people who were having affairs. The overall zeh at a certain point. The overall zeh v'kinel ishto v'nistra v'lo hevia l'koin lasos l'maisa kosu v'parsha b'itala seizeh. And if you did the kinoi, and your wife became secluded with this man, and you didn't do the procedure to her, then you neglected to perform this positive commandment.